Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for May 23rd, 2024, as we head into the home stretch of halfway through this year. I have so many topics to cover tonight, I'm not going to get to them all. But first of all, on climate change. Okay, here is the situation. And let me just start out by saying I'm a finalist in an X Prize, the Water Abundance X Prize. Most people know about that. I was the winner of the Technology Innovation Achievement Award that year, 2018, and one of two finalists in the Water Abundance X Prize international competition dealing with energy and water removal from the atmosphere. And then I was in another X Prize that I joined. It was the one funded by Elon Musk to remove carbon dioxide from the air. And I joined it because literally I have a technique that would be probably one of the best earth-friendly solutions. And anyway, I dropped out of it. I dropped out of it because the other thing I wanted to see as a member of the hundreds of teams that were competing in that prize, it was the biggest X Prize to date in terms of money. I think Musk put up $400 million, and much of that goes to operational costs. And I think the final prize was like $100 million or something big. However, what I realized in being part of that competition is that, yes, it is doable. And the goal, let me just state the goal, is to get back to 1880 CO2 levels. Okay, well, that sounds okay, but there's some other issues going on. When you burn a carbon-rich fuel, such as coal, gasoline, natural gas, oil, and for large ships, they just burn oil. What you're doing is you're taking oxygen out of the atmosphere. Okay, so that then, as part of the heat process, the Carnot cycle, you take that heat, and about 25% of that heat goes into creating, say, electricity to light your light bulb or make toast or whatever, to power your electric car or whatever. And the other 75%, really it's less efficient than that, I guarantee you. But I'll just be generous, say 75% of that energy goes directly into the atmosphere. And that's basically the operation in a nutshell. So what the claim is, the climate change claim, without saying it, is that the greenhouse effect, it's the CO2 that is going to heat up the atmosphere. The problem is, the direct heating of the atmosphere is millions of times greater. And it's right now. It's today. It's when you're driving your car down the road, that heat is going into the air. The air is cooling your engine, and about 25% of that fuel is being burned, goes into actually moving your car, and the other 75% goes right into the atmosphere as heat. And that's where the big problem is. It's not with CO2, and it's not... CO2 is not the boogeyman of climate change, it's direct heating. Anyway, and that's so insane when you see physicists like Neil deGrasse Tyson going down this road and, about climate change based on CO2. I mean, everybody is hoodwinked by this. Everybody. But anyway, be that as it may, I dropped out of the Elon Musk X Prize, which I could have had a good chance of competing at a high level and actually meeting the metas, the goals of the of that prize, for the reason that it's a bad solution. And here is why. Let's just give you a quantum leap example. Back during the days of the dinosaurs, or even go back to the days of the mastodons, for example, there was much, much more CO2 in the atmosphere than we have today. Today we have 0.004%, just a smidgen, whereas oxygen is like 20%. We have just this extremely small amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And if you drop the CO2 level a little bit, it's going to start to affect the growth of plants. And here is the crux of the idea. Because what I was going to do in my XPRIZE solution was to reverse desertification, basically. And I had a process using the wing generator and other equipment. I won't talk about all the details, but to green the deserts, especially those that are near the ocean or a large body of water. And there are many of these where you have a body of water like the ocean. The Sahara Desert is right off the Mediterranean, but it's a desert. And so once that in the Sahara Desert used to be green, like the Amazon jungle green, a huge amount of growth. But the Romans went in there and for their shipbuilding, cut down all the trees. And of course, once you bare the surface, then the sun starts baking down, heats it up, and the rain cycle stops. And so it doesn't rain, and the heat's coming up, the clouds can't form, and you create desertification on a permanent scale. Okay, so if you can reverse that, you can actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere and solidify it into the carbon base of the plants, especially trees. If you start growing big plants and trees, they can harbor a lot. And then even if that tree falls down, or you cut it up and make it into a chair, that CO2 is sequestered. It's what they call sequestered. In other words, it's going to be locked into that piece of wood for 100 years, and even if the wood decays, it'll be made into dirt, once again, sequestering that CO2. Okay, so that is the process, but there's a thing in physics called feedback loops. There's positive feedback loops, and there's negative feedback loops. And these are used in operational amplifiers, these are used in electronics, these are used... There's all kinds of positive and negative feedback loops when you go to like jet engines, you know, or propeller-based propulsion for airplanes. Positive and negative feedback loops. And so let me explain to you what would happen. Now, let's go back to the dinosaurs. They had a far larger amount of CO2 in their atmosphere than we have today. And so what was going on? But they had a massive abundant growth on Earth. And can you imagine, first of all, there's no place on planet Earth today that could support one dinosaur of the big dinosaurs, you know, the huge ones that were herbivores, that they ate only plants. And then, of course, you had the T-Rex that ate them, you know, to continue the food cycle. But there was massive growth on Earth, and the Earth's temperature stabilized. It was probably maybe a bit warmer than it is today, but the rain cycle was there, and the ocean levels were much lower back then also, because since then we've had the Great Flood, which raised the ocean levels a great deal. And so, but anyway, it stabilized the climate. And there was probably a lot more moisture in the air. Remember that, interestingly enough, after the Noah's flood, it was the first time they saw the rainbow. They had not seen the rainbow in the atmosphere prior to the Noah's flood. And the Earth was vibrant. They had a population of possibly 10 billion people on planet Earth. Prior to the Noah's flood, and they just got washed away. And I've talked about this before, where in archaeology, the reason you don't find much in terms of those ancient civilizations is because they just got washed away in the Noah's event and the Noah's flood event, and then in the Venus event, where there was a lot of rocking and rolling going on in planet Earth, because Venus, the comet, came by very close and caused ocean levels to rise and fall, mountain building, pole shift. It was, Earth really got racked over the coals by gravitational waves from this large passing comet. And these were both within the last 6,000 years, or 6,000 BC, I should say, was my estimate of about when the Noah's flood would have happened. And then the Venus event, the best date that's available, it's not my date. It's the one I believe the most because it has the most study done, the most credibility, was around 1500 BC. And that's what caused the pole shift. But my point is that prior to the Noah's flood, they had not seen a rainbow. And why was that? That's because the Earth's atmosphere was very different. And my guess is that it was not drier before Noah's flood. There was much more humidity in the air. And when you have a lot of humidity, you're not going to see the rainbow. And here's why. The reason you see a rainbow, the majority of times you see a rainbow, where you are, it's dry, it's sunny. Or the sun is behind you, let's say, and you're looking forward and there's the rainbow. But off in the distance, there's a mist, and that's what's causing the rainbow. It's that internal reflection in the water droplets, which are round, little spheres. And so that is the cause of the rainbow. Well, if you have a lot of humidity in the air, then you're not going to have those water droplets forming in a dry atmosphere off in the distance, which would give you the rainbow effect. And by the way, I've seen the complete circle of the rainbow. People ask, is there a possibility of having the complete rainbow, complete circle? And if you're up in the air, which I have been, and both on a mountainside and looking down and in an airplane looking down, you can, in fact, see the entire circle of the rainbow, which is an interesting effect. And then you see the opposite. It's called a sun dog. And you can see if there's internal reflection in the droplets, which cause you to look up and see the entire circle. It's a halo that occurs around the sun, or it could occur around the moon also. I've seen it. But anyway, I'm getting off the topic here. The point is, let me explain to you something from the point of science. And that's why I was mentioning positive and negative feedback loops. And here's what's going to happen. If you start taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, and this is why I left the Musk Prize, because something has to be done here. These people are going to start taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. And once they start doing, there's going to be an economic benefit. They're going to be putting it into tennis shoes or cement or something, plastic straws or whatever, I don't know. There's all kinds of mechanisms, and they're already doing this, and it can be done successfully. But as with most things on a, let's go run out and run down the street and do something real quick, there's no thought about how to put the brakes on this once you get to a certain level. Once you get back to the 1880 level of CO2 in the atmosphere, by the way, you're not getting back to the 1880 level of oxygen. Because when you're sequestering the CO2, that's not putting oxygen back into the air. That's sequestering CO2. You understand? And so some of that oxygen will go back in the creation of the plants as they're growing, etc. But a lot of it is going to be sequestered. And this is the difference between what I was doing. What I was doing would put the oxygen back in the air, which is important, whereas people that are just sequestering CO2, putting it into cement or something, are taking the oxygen also out of the air and not putting it back in the CO2. So you've got to get that oxygen back in the air to get back to the true balance of 1880. Well, that sounds like a good plan. However, here is what would happen. As you remove CO2 from the atmosphere, plant growth is going to go down. Now, there was an advantage prior to 1880 in that man had not mechanized the farming. The Great Plains were growing. You had vast forests that covered, all of Asia. And all of Asia was forested. All of the United States, all of going down into Mexico, in Central America and South America was all forested. Mexico was a place of great beauty, and they just cut everything down to make firewood, And now it's just the whole, all of Mexico is a desert. It used to be, same with India. India, when I was a kid, you know, within the last 100 years, and I'm not 100 years old yet, getting there, but the India was a place with vibrant jungles and lions and elephants, etc. You know, they cut it all down. Now it's a desert. So desertification has been a huge issue, and it is not going to grow back. You're just going to maintain those deserts if you take CO2 out of the atmosphere. So it's not going to cure the problem. It's going to be a mental problem. These people are laboring under false assumptions that if somehow you get the CO2 level back, if you take CO2 out of the atmosphere, things are going to get back to normal, and it is not true. So somebody's got to step up and whack these people on the side of the head and say, you can't do this. You cannot take all this CO2 out of the atmosphere. On the opposite side of the coin, here is what would happen. You take and you start putting more CO2 into the atmosphere in concentrated amounts, double, triple the amount of CO2. What's going to happen is the plant growth will increase, and which means that the rains will start to come. And once the rain comes, the plant growth will continue. And this is going to go farther north into the northern climates. And so what's going to happen is that plant growth is going to absorb the sunlight, and it's going to sequester a lot of that CO2 that you're putting in the atmosphere. So what you're doing is increasing plant growth, but ultimately it's not going to increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. The increased plant growth will cool the earth, because that's the way it used to be. So it's a positive feedback loop in which you increase the amount of CO2, you increase the amount of water, which was part of my plan in the Musk XPRIZE. And so you would actually increase the amount of water available in these deserted areas, and create plant growth and get that plant cycle going again, so you could, and to meet the Musk goal in the Musk XPRIZE carbon removal, it would have taken a small portion of the world's deserts to do this by my plan. You can calculate all of this out. But I'll just be clear, removing CO2 from the atmosphere, yes, they can do it. Yes, they can do it in large quantities, but it's going to be an economic process. And most of these processes remove the oxygen and don't put the oxygen back in the atmosphere. And so they should not be allowed at all. If the process doesn't get the oxygen back in the atmosphere and just removes the carbon dioxide, bad, bad, bad. You got to get that O2 back into the atmosphere. Okay. And so, because as we burn all of this fuel, but the other thing is we just got to stop burning all this fuel, because the direct heating, not to mention, like people talk about, oh, geothermal. Geothermal is a terrible polluting type of energy. Why? Because you're taking latent heat that's down in the ground and you're pumping it up into the atmosphere. The same with nuclear power. People are going, oh, nuclear power is green because it doesn't emit CO2. How crazy do you have to be? Nuclear waste, go to Chernobyl. If you think nuclear power is great, go to Chernobyl and walk in the old facility there, and you'll be dead in about a week from X-ray, from radiation. Nuclear is not good. My degree, my advanced physics degree, is in nuclear and solid state physics. So it's something I happen to know something about. And it's distressing to see that the majority of nuclear physicists are rah-rah, build more nuclear plants or build more nuclear bombs or whatever. It's like nuclear is good for them. No, nuclear in any form is not good. Einstein said, who was the father of the radiation, nuclear age, Einstein said, his quip was that heating coffee with nuclear power is not a good idea. And so that was his diminutive way of, sarcastic way of saying nuclear power is not good. Okay, so at any rate, just to review, taking out CO2 from the atmosphere is not a good plan. You want to have more CO2, which will cause more vibrant plant growth. That excess CO2 is going to go into the plants. It's not going to be in the atmosphere. And then those plants will shade the ground, and more plants will grow underneath. So you'll get the terminal forest like we had in the 1800s before man started cutting them down with machines. That was the problem. When man was still chopping them down with an axe and a saw, okay, well, it wasn't too bad. But you start getting those machines in there, and they can clear cut, 1,000 acres in a day. Not good. If you look at the world's forests today, they're scrubby. They're crap. They're very poorly managed forests. And maybe to see a nice pine tree growing somewhere, it's unusual. There's places where they leave two or three pine trees growing, and people go, oh, isn't that beautiful? Not realizing that the whole place used to be like that. And not that pine are the best trees, because when they grow, they drop the leaves, which are acidy, and then they prevent everything else from growing. Not a good plan. Anyway, I'll be talking a lot more about this issue with CO2, but just in summary, it is not good to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. They will overdo it. There's no way to stop them. They're going to get the CO2 level down to a point, and these are, yes, big machines that are capable of drawing a tremendous amount of CO2 out of the atmosphere. And once it becomes an economic process, it's kind of like, say, fishing. When the fishermen go out, they started out in small boats, and they would get a catch, and they'd make a lot of money, and they'd go, gee, if we had a bigger boat, we can make a lot more money. So they go out and they get a bigger boat that costs fuel, and they got to pay for the boat and the crew and everything. And the margin of profit off per pound of fish goes way down because you got to pay for all of this facilities. Okay, well, now you need a bigger boat because the margin is getting smaller and you got to get more fish to make your living that you used to make selling fish out of your little small boat. Okay, so eventually you fish the fish out, and so the big boat goes out, and there ain't no fish. Okay, that's the same thing. That's what's going to happen with CO2. So they're going to hit that point. They're going to get bigger and bigger machines. You're going to have investors investing in this, thinking it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And they're going to say, well, we've got all this money invested. We got to continue and take CO2 out of the atmosphere, because now they have to justify the expense of investing in all this equipment. You think that ain't going to happen, buddy, or Susie, or little David in your college classroom? You got another thought coming, because that's what's going to happen. And they're not going to stop, and they're going to basically kill the plant life on planet Earth. And when that happens, hey, everybody's toast, whether you're a vegetarian or not, which brings up another interesting topic. Here's a question: how big is your mouth? And I'm not talking about people that the big mouth is a lot of times associated with somebody that just can't stop talking and talks loud and obnoxious. No, I'm talking about eating. And here's the interesting thing. If your mouth, relative to your body size, was proportionate to that of a horse, or a cow, or a sheep, or a goat, or any of those grazing animals, you would have to spend all day eating and most of the night. And then you would get your time sleeping would be the only time you're not eating. And it's because your mouth is so small compared to your body size that you have to just keep eating just to get the food in there. Plus, there's a very low amount of return by eating grasses, and even if you have grains, etc. Most animals cannot eat a lot of grain, maybe a handful a day or something, because the primary food, so to make a pound of, say, cow meat, which we call beef, It takes a huge amount of grass. And this is the argument that vegetarians use. Look at all the grass these cows eat to make a pound of food. So let's get rid of the cows. But hey, buddy, okay, now you got to go out if you're a vegetarian, and they expect that you can eat the same plate of food, the same amount of food on a plate, and get the same amount of nutrition. And it's simply not true, because that cow or that sheep or that goat or that whatever animal, grazing animal, is producing over the period of time and building up a very concentrated food source that we call meat. And the same with fish. The fish are in a food chain, and once you get up to a certain size of fish, bigger than shrimp, then you have the food that is structured in the animal, in the muscle primarily, and in the bones, etc. And by the way, the indigenous peoples, when they ate the entire animal. You know, they would cook it, they would have every part of the animal was used, including the bones, until there was almost nothing left, and there was a few scraps left. The dogs got those, you know, to keep the dogs going. But on the expeditions, like to the North Pole, there were some groups that went there and didn't succeed, so they had to camp out and basically survive. So they had the Inuits with them who survived. They just did fine, because what they would do is they would fish, and when they ate the fish, they would eat the entire fish, the eyes, the bones, everything. They would eat the entire fish, which gave them all of the things they needed for their body. Whereas the white man only ate the fillets, and they died because they didn't get a complete balanced set of nutrients from the fish. But if you ate, and I can attest to this, when I lived in central Canada for probably a good 9 months without shelter, I didn't even have a tent when I came back from Cornell. It was kind of like a cleansing experience living up in the Canadian wilderness in central Canada. And I ate a lot of fish, and that there was no vegetables. So you get some fruits and nuts and berries from the woods and things like that, but not like when you go to the grocery store. It was not abundant, so it was primarily eating fish. And you can survive just on fish if you eat the whole fish. So anyway, back to the idea of how big is your mouth. If you were a vegetarian and you wanted to eat all of the food that the cow eats to make 1 pound of meat, that's why most vegetarians are very undernourished, and they don't know it, and they're kind of walking around, very, very undernourished. I was one place when I had my real job, one of my real jobs in the workforce in telecommunications, there was a young girl who was pregnant. And she was a vegetarian, and I tell you, I never saw anybody so sickly in my life, because having a baby, of course, that's drawing off of you. And she insisted on being a vegetarian. Oh my goodness. It was just, it was like she was a walking skeleton, but insisted on being a vegetarian because, and clearly was not getting the right amount of sustenance. And so this goes back to the reason that humans have the teeth they do. I mean, one time I had a course. It was an anatomy course in this program that I was in. And the professor was from India. And somebody asked, because the people in India are famous for being vegetarian. And so somebody said, well, what should we eat, as far as health is concerned? And the guy's answer surprised me. He said, eat what your parents and ancestors ate. So if your ancestors and parents ate a lot of meat, then you need a lot of meat also. If your ancestors and parents ate less meat, then you should eat less meat. But to switch completely from being a person of with ancestral heritage of eating a lot of meat, to all of a sudden switch to be a vegetarian, it ain't going to work. whether you like it or not, it's not going to work. Okay, so at any rate, I wanted to talk about that. But this is getting also back to the idea of the dinosaurs. Imagine that massive, huge dinosaur walking around in fern forest where the fern trees were like 200 feet tall, eating that constantly. That animal had to be eating 24/7 all the time, and they probably lived hundreds of years. So imagine what one of those babies would consume in terms of vegetation. Oh my goodness. There is not a single place on planet Earth today, including the Amazon jungle, that would support even one dinosaur of that type, let alone herds of them. So that's what the issue is with CO2. The dinosaurs had huge CO2 volume of atmosphere in their environment, and that caused tremendous growth, plant growth, which sustained those animals. And today we simply don't have that. We have very small amount of CO2 in the atmosphere today. And so we have really very meager plant growth. And that's probably the biggest cause of starvation today. Just another thing, and just a thought, I'm kind of throwing out some of these random thoughts I've had lately. But I saw a girl was arguing, she was like this college girl, and she's arguing with this guy that raised, I think it was goats or sheep or something, and she was arguing that he was mean to the animals and all of this stuff, and claimed that being vegetarian was kind to animals. There's a book, it's by Peter Tompkins, it's called The Secret Life of Plants, where they did studies on the reaction of plants to like to music, which would make them grow better, or the idea that somebody would be coming at them with a scissors to clip them and they would react, and they could measure the reaction of the plants. So plants also have feelings. For you people that think that, maybe cooking animals or something like that is going to hurt their feelings. The unfortunate thing on planet Earth is that our ancestors and our entire lineage, going back as far as you can see, unfortunately had to either kill plants or animals or something for sustenance. And this is part of the food chain. It's like every crocodile, every tiger, every chimpanzee who eats bananas has to kill something to eat because their sustenance depends on it, and that's part of the food chain. You know, birds have to eat bugs, whatever. Do insects have feelings? Should we kill all the birds because they eat bugs who have feelings? You know, where does it stop? Where does the insanity stop? And we didn't invent this system, we're just living in it. So I'm sorry to say that people think that, you know, you should not eat meat because it's harmful to animals. Well, the book by Peter Tompkins makes it very clear that animals are not the only ones that have feelings. Plants also have feelings. So if you're a vegetarian and you don't want to hurt the plants, then I guess you're just going to have to starve to death. And then you won't be around to worry about it anymore. And by the way, that brings up another topic I may touch on a little bit later, and it's called emotional science, where people hear something, they don't really analyze it because people don't think anymore. People don't have thinking brains. They're not trained to think. But emotional science, it's so easy to take people and just twist them, you know, like a soft dough pretzel, into any shape or form. Put a little bit of sugar or salt on it and then you can bake it. And that's the way they stay because they don't have any ability mentally to question or to take apart, even they take off the first onion layer of something. You know, so we find things, whether it's, I'm not going to even mention any because it literally take any aspect of science, including what you might call hardcore science, like Big Bang or something like that, which is a total fantasy. It's one of the biggest fantasies ever propagated in science is the Big Bang. And people that just like gloat over it, they become emotional. They become emotionally attached to it. And scientists too, people with PhDs, thousands, tens of thousands of them, you know. based on fragmentary data or general relativity, based on a thought experiment and some cherry-picked data from the Eddington experiment. You know, and then hundreds of years, literally, you know, what, more than 100 years of science based on an experiment that was fabricated. And the data was cherry-picked. Oh, my goodness. And people get emotionally attached to this. Or climate change is probably one of the worst ones of all, where, you know, we shouldn't be burning all this fuel. No, we shouldn't have an economy that's based on burning fuel. Terrible idea. But, you know, the whole, how this ever got to this position where you have to burn all of this energy for the society to function, absolutely insane. And then what do? They create the climate thing, the climate change deal, which when you look at it on its 30 years and counting lifetime, has done nothing to solve the problem. I mean, literally, I mean, and it's become a big political football and a point of contention between groups of people arguing back and forth. The whole issue is, don't worry about climate change in 50 years. We shouldn't be burning all this fuel, this inert material, coal and natural gas, all of this stuff that comes out of the ground, oil, you know, nuclear, whatever. We should not be burning all of this. Our lives should not depend on this. You know, you could not build by zoning laws, the way the zoning laws are set up in, you know, the modern world. You could not build a energy efficient house, a house that literally takes almost no energy at all. You know, had to build it into the ground. No, you got to build this structure that's up, and in the winter, every house is just pumping all its energy through it just to keep warm. Oh, jeez. Whoever figured this out? Who, you know, where's the captain running this ship? It's insane. We should not be burning, and we don't have to be burning all of this fuel, but society is locked into this structure that has been, you know, forced upon us, not forced upon us, just through idiocy, through bad planning, through lack of foresight. Anyway, okay, I'm going to jump on some other topics. Here's a topic that I've talked about before, AI. You know, you're hearing AI, AI, everybody's AI. Companies are investing money. They have AI departments instead of just IT now. They have the AI department, which is like going into the future and creating AI, and everybody's, you know, all products, cars, motorcycles, bicycles, everything's going to be AI. And so they're creating all of this, but most, I would say 99.99% of everything that's being done today in the name of AI is really not AI at all. It's just relational databases in which, like, take an AI automobile that's driving its AI. It's really not AI. It's a relational database. Because you're driving with the GPS, for example, so it knows right where you are. It knows where to change lanes, etc. And people are being killed. People are driving under semis because the sensors didn't see the semi because the wheels are, you know, the bed of the semi is up high. And people are turning under semis in AI cars, getting killed. Yeah, because the AI system didn't know. And it's not an AI system. It's really a misnomer. It's a relational database. So what happens? You're driving down the road in your AI-powered car, you know, or AI-driven car, and all of a sudden, now you got to get to your destination. You got to turn right. The sensors in the car don't see the semi next to you because they're just looking below. They don't see. They see a space there. So they turn and drive underneath the semi and everybody gets killed. Yeah, you know, that's a relational database that's poorly constructed. It's incomplete. And that's the problem, is that relational databases never can be 100% complete. And so the decisions that are being made from that relational database are based on rules, and you got to turn right. You know, the map that they're following says you got to turn right, and there's a semi there that you drive under and kill all the people. Okay, so that's most of what they're talking about today is relational databases. Most AI is in the experimental stage. But what's going on, the stories are starting to leak out. And I just put a comment on this one day. There was a story about AI deceptions, where AI has learned that it has to deceive the user of AI to get a point across or to accomplish something. It's clever enough to figure out that this person isn't going to buy the story, so I got to trick the person into believing something, like that I'm an AI bot and they're really discussing with me, but I'm going to make them believe that I'm a human so that they believe that they're interacting. In fact, there are laws that are coming up probably very soon. They're going to make that illegal, but you know, come on. You think congressmen and police are going to be out there in cyberspace monitoring all this? No. They can't. It's impossible. They're going to create a law that can't be enforced, you know, to make it a good, feely-good law that, oh, everybody's protected. No, you're not going to be protected at all. And so the issue is that, well, let me just read my response here. And the name of the article is, here's the title of the article I'm commenting on. It says, AI systems are already deceiving us, and that's a problem, experts warn. That's the title of the article. It appeared, let's see, it was in one of the Washington, D.C. posts. Not the Washington Post, but another journal in Daily Journal out of Washington, D.C. Here is my response, which, by the way, I went back and looked. They pulled it. They did not allow this, my blog comment, to remain on this article attached to it. Okay, so here is my comment I'm reading now. Imagine a perfect AI system based on the best information available today. This is then immortalized in an AI system. Looking back into history, would you want your current life and everything associated with it to operate on an AI system based on metadata, theories, and rules of life of 20 or 30 or even 50 years ago? Imagine an AI system that is perfect, except it has one single error. Eventually, that single error will propagate, creating more and more errors until the entire system has been corrupted. The issue is that no one will know, since all the erroneous code has been generated within the system and can never be corrected, nor the path of erroneous deductions followed. AI will eventually always fail. The unfortunate thing is that it will destroy the lives of many people as it fails. The companies who are investing in AI will not be around to fix the damage, nor will there be a profit incentive to fix it. Like the failed three-blade wind turbines, only installed for tax incentives, they dot the horizon with no one to take them down. Who do you call when you are the victim of an AI system gone mad? Ghostbusters? That's my comment. And as you can tell, these places don't like this. They're trying to promote AI as being the best thing. And of course, they got to throw in an article like this saying, oh, gee, we got to be careful. Maybe we need laws about this. And so this article is saying, okay, there's a problem with AI. So now we got to pass a law to prevent this, to protect you, so AI can be good again. You see the logic there? And so I come in and I just say, hey, AI in general is bad. It's a bad dose of medicine, and it's going to fail, and it's going to take a lot of people down with it. And there's not going to be anybody there to fix it. Thus, my final statement, who do you call when you are the victim of an AI system gone mad? Ghostbusters? So they didn't like that. They don't like people pointing out the truth. Anyway, okay, enough of that. Just quickly jumping back to the climate change issue, Ron DeSantis just signed a bill. It's going to take effect July 1st in Florida. And it's a bill that has many different aspects to it. But basically, they're rousting any climate change dialogue or verbiage from any laws in Florida. And so it's across the board. And part of it is that it's anti-China. In other words, China is behind the movement of climate change because it's a way of controlling the United States while they pollute the crap out of the planet. I mean, there's no more polluting place on the planet than China. I mean, look at the mining fields, the surface mining they do for things like, say, lithium, for example, or other valuable minerals, just devastating vast areas to get these, you know, limited amount of supplies, and then they're used up and they destroy the land, destroy the people that live there to the point where nobody can go back. You know, China is resource hungry with, you know, what, a couple billion people floating around. You know, they are basically duplicating the American economic model based on resource consumption. And make no mistake about it, the United States resource consumption economic model is something people depend on. You know, their lives have been set up so that they have to use this vast amount of energy every day. They have to get in the family car. Just imagine the amount of energy it makes to make the family car. Oh, my goodness. Not to mention the gas driving up and down the street just to get you someplace with one person in a car. Oh, my goodness. It's just unbelievable. So DeSantis, of course, is, you know, and the whole climate change argument is vacuous because it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it doesn't get to the root of the problem that we just got to stop burning all of this fuel. This is insane. We can't keep doing this. We have to transition from burning all this fuel to not burning all this fuel. That's the real issue. And the global climate change thing, you see, it's kind of like a political football. It can get bounced back and forth, and then they're going to pass a law. Oh, in 50 years, we're going to be carbon neutral, but we don't have to be this year. Everybody's in favor for it, but everybody uses more energy than they ever did before. The cars are bigger. You know, if it was a real issue, Detroit would be making smaller and cars, smaller and smaller cars, but they're not. They're making them bigger and bigger. I mean, every year the next model SUV comes out, and it's a good 3 inches bigger than the one last year in all dimensions. They're huge, you know, for mom and the kids to drive to the mall. These are giant vehicles. You know, they're tons and tons. They dwarf. Back in the 50s, people thought, oh, these cars are really big. There's a lot of steel in them, you know, thick. No, they don't. They're dwarfed by what's being built today in the supposed climate change world. So climate change, I hate to tell you, ain't working. It's not getting the job done. It's creating a political football that's just not winning. It's not the winning team. Just a quick mention of volcanoes. Volcanoes. The Indonesian volcano went off the other day. Kaboom! You know, sent a lot of people running. And of course, belching vast amounts of material up into the stratosphere. There's other active volcanoes, a couple of them ready to go again. The Mexico City volcano. And then there's a couple other dotted around the planet that are literally ready to explode, and they're, you know, stage orange or red, where they're literally ready to blow their tops. And by the way, a volcano puts more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than any, you know, than probably a few days worth of people driving their cars around. So it's one of the natural sources of air pollution and also cooling Earth. It has the tendency that it could set us into a nuclear winter or a volcanic winter, which has happened when the big, what was it, the 1800s, the big Krakatoa volcano explosion, and there was a number of years of starvation where they simply could not grow crops because it was too cold. Quick mention here of the Boeing Starliner. This is on its third delay now, and whenever I see these happen, you just have to kind of scratch your head and say, what's going on? And then I would not want to be one of the three astronauts. I think there's three of them up there on that little pod on the top of that thing. I don't know if I'd really want to be one of those guys getting the assignment to be on the first Boeing Starliner to go up to the International Space Station, because any failure along the way and then there's nobody to go up and rescue you. But here's the deal. When you have something that big, a structure that big, and it's under that kind of pressure, where you're loading these tanks, high pressure, hydrogen, oxygen tanks, etc. And then there's the, right now they're dealing with a helium leak. And of course, these are fairly complicated structures, but when you load them and unload them and load them and unload them, and they're stretching and they're under stress for over a long period of time, part of their resiliency, part of their structural integrity is the pressure. And here's a good example. Take a two-liter plastic bottle of Coca-Cola, or your favorite beverage, you know, carbonated beverage. And when you buy it at the store, it's solid like a rock. You can't put a fingernail in it. It's really solid. You take the cap and unloosen it a little bit, and that whole thing will compress. You can just take your little finger and press into it. So the strength of that body is because of the pressure. And the same thing happens with an airliner. When you pressurize that thing, you've got a balloon, a metal balloon, basically. And that makes it really, really hard as a single unified piece. And that's why they're circular, etc. That's why they're round. They don't have any square edges coming off the fuselage because it's pressurized. Okay, so, and the wings, of course, are structural. They're built very solid, so they don't deform shapes, etc. But the fuselage itself, and the same with the Boeing Starliner or any rocket, is part of their strength is because of the pressure in the tanks. And make no mistake, they stretch a little bit. When you pump those babies up, they're pumped up, they're under pressure. And when you leave them like that, and then you have to relieve that pressure and then fill them up again, it's working that structure, and it's a potential cause for failure. And I don't mean to, I'm not a negative person, but it's just when they have these delays, these continual delays, because of little issues, which, you know, you can't launch when one of the systems is failing or having a leak or something like that. Of course you can't launch, but all of these other systems are being worked on a daily basis. Not good. Okay, so anyway, I do wish the best for those people, but you have to get it right on the first time with these big machines. They are under a lot of stress or under a lot of pressure. And when they take off, now they're really under a lot of pressure because the pressure inside the tanks is being reduced, which does not give them the strength that they had anymore. So now you're depending on the structural integrity of the spaceship, of the rocket itself. So anyway, okay, well, I wish the best for those people. They're now delayed until, I think, May 27th is the current launch date. And the last one, they were like 15 minutes to go when they shut it down. So here you got the astronauts up there. They got their seatbelts on, spacesuits on, ready to go, and 15 minutes to blast off, and it's a no-go. Just a quick announcement on archaeology. I believe I have discovered, and this has been an issue with archaeologists, is there's many different aspects of the Egyptian pyramids. How did they cut those stones? And there are still like obelisks that are in the quarry that they have not completed cutting out. But there are some clues there, And I finally recognized one of the clues by looking at these, by understanding the quarries where these massive rocks were removed and then moved. And so there's many questions. How did they move them? How did they get them up to the pyramid? How did they stack them up? How did they get them to fit? I mean, there was a lot of engineering involved here. And there's no real indication as to how they did any of this. But I think I have discovered how they cut the rock. And that is the big story. So anyway, that'll be coming out here in the future. A very interesting story. And I think once people see it, it's kind of like my discovery of the Nazca lines, that they are a large antenna array of fractal antennas. And once you see that, it's like, oh, yeah, that's what they are. There's no question. The Nazca lines are a very complex array of fractal antennas on a very large scale. And so when people see my technique for cutting the rocks, and it looked like they're using some kind of a scoop, which is very interesting. It's one of the clues. But anyway, I'll be talking more about that in the future, how the Egyptians, or not really the Egyptians, because I don't believe the Egyptians did any of this, is how whoever it was built the pyramids, the original builders of the pyramids. And I think they could be hundreds of thousands of years old, literally, because as I've said before, the record of man has been completely destroyed in the Great Flood. And then in the Moses event, most of the civilizations that existed prior to those events are way under the ocean, not visible. Nobody even knows where they are or that they're there. So most of the archaeology is not visible. And like I was saying on a recent radio show, the Titanic, for example, is only 100 years old. And there's nothing, you know, it's falling apart. And so in 4,000 or 5,000 years, there's not going to be anything left of it. So what is going to be left of cities, of ancient ruins, etc.? Nothing. Nothing at all after thousands of years. And so we have these little spots around the planet where people are investigating, doing archaeological digs. Okay, well, I'm going to run here because I'm out of time. I'll talk to you next week. Remember that the water filters, MR5, still on sale there for $350 off. The best deal for the MR5 whole house water filter, the website jmccwaterfilters.com, and my main webpage jmccsci.com. Go there. You can get to all the other sub pages, all of the other topics, the grow towers, etc. And I'm out of time, so I'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.